Now I hear that.
You hear my typing? I was asking, do you need us to make noise so you can verify if it's working?
Yeah, that works. Discord's right. Weird sometimes. It's sometimes Discord sometimes just like I like the tech. I like how clean the audio tends to be over it, but every so often the like when it's setting itself up and it's trying to pick which audio input and output device to use, it sometimes just goes completely in the opposite direction of where it needs to go, and then you have to go into the settings and make a bunch of adjustments and say, no, you should actually use that mic and those speakers. And well, in the interest of time, I can do an intro. That's fine. We haven't done an intro in forever.
We haven't done a recording in forever.
Also that. Well, welcome back to another episode of Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug. This is episode 90, and we're actually recording again. It's been far too long since I think we've sat down and actually had one of these recording sessions. And that's entirely on me and my completely upended schedule from about midsummer onward. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about Ultima Online because as of last weekend, the 24th of September, I believe was the official date, Ultima Online, the grandfather of MMORPGs, as it is sometimes called, 20 years, 20th anniversary for that. I'm still processing that number. I can't even contemplate it in, such terms. So while I let that number stew in my brain a little bit more, this episode of Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug is, of course, brought to you by our Patreon backers. Thank you to everyone who supports the podcast and the Codex by that means. And as always, a big hearty thank you to our co-producers, Seth, Dominic, Chris, Violation, Adam, Eric, Thorwan, Pascal, Helgruff, Aaron, The Hearth of Britannia, Edward, Stirring Dragon, and Cranberry. Right, so I figure we're just going to dive right into topic because we actually have a very special guest with us tonight, Designer Dragon himself. Rafe Costa, is it Raf or Rafe? I've never actually gotten that.
Raf, unless you're from the United Kingdom.
Okay.
I give him a pass if you're from over there. Rafe is pretty common over there.
Okay, Raf Costa is with us tonight, and you can hear him right there.
Hi.
Hello, and thank you.
My pleasure.
That was just like a complete Hail Mary pass as far as tweets go. It's just like, we're doing this thing. And I'm flattered that you could actually make it out. Thank you.
Golden Flame, your typing is extremely audible.
Yes. Are you typing Golden Flame? I was going to say.
This is why I usually remember to hit mute.
Ah, there we go. So anyways, Golden Flame Dragon is also with us as well. Hi, guy.
Hi, I'm here with my typing. It's yes. A circus act.
And you're recuperating all right?
I'm recuperating, better than expected. Yes, I had hip surgery on Wednesday. I do every now and then have to remind myself that I actually paid people to do this to me. Mm. But I am on crutches for the next 3 weeks. Ugh.
Well, don't try and rush it. You do want the use of your hip again.
Yeah, it'd be kind of nice.
Totally. We also have Ravelox Dragon. Hi, Ravelox. How you doing?
Oh, I'm all right. How are you?
I'm good. I'm real good. Today was a great day.
Guys. I've been tied up like for most of the month trying to repair my house. So the squirrels have decided to try to, in the third year running, make a home out of my chimney chase. So this time around, I've decided to tear down everything and rebuild it.
Nice. Squirrels are remarkably adept at causing problems. Do you know there have been more squirrel-related power outages in the United States than there have been due to cyber events?
I believe it.
Mm-hmm. And I also see Vansilar Dragon just pinged in. Hello. Or perhaps he is just lurking.
People just reported his microphone not working.
Oh, no. Yes, I see that now. Oh, mic not working on that computer. Lurking. Well, if you can get the mic working, feel free to chime in. Anyways, like I say, right to topic because, wow, Ultima Online, 20 years. And, I mean, gosh, I don't even know where to start because it's like, how do you encapsulate two decades worth of the game in, in this? I mean, I think obviously the game is still being developed as much as it can be by Broadsword. They're a small team, so it's not like they have the resources to do like massive and fundamental changes to it. Although they did just wrap up a story arc that tried to incorporate some of the events of, well, not the events of Ultima 8, but, you know, characters and bits of lore from Ultima 8. So, you know, nice to see them reaching into the single player series to grab inspiration and grab content and tell a story around that. And they just wrapped up that event arc. But the other thing that they did as part of their 20th anniversary celebration was announced that they've got a free-to-play mode in the game. Well, sort of like a free-to-play mode. It's called Endless Journey, and it gives you access to a lot of the game. But of course you don't have access to like housing and the bank and, a significant amount of other content. So, you know, you're still able to explore the game, explore the world, and you have everything up to the Stygian Abyss expansion, which is good. But, yeah, that's, I don't know, on one hand, not surprising that they went that route. And hopefully it does invigorate a little bit of interest in the game, or at least, you know, gets a lot of people on board to give it a try. And on the other hand, I mean, UO, like, it's awesome that UO continues to be present in the market and evidently profitable enough to, you know, continue being developed in the MMO market today, given just how much it has changed, and how much the MMO market has changed. But gosh, I don't know. I really am tempted to just like kick it back to the beginning and and let Designer Dragon, let Raph just enlighten us with gosh, anything, because I honestly, like, I am just at a loss for where to start. I mean, we've heard a lot of the stories about the genesis of the game, although I do have to note, like, Dr. Cat lurks the Spam 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 Humbug Discord channel occasionally, and he mentioned that UO, as we know it, was roughly the third attempt at creating, like, a multiplayer Ultima game.
Yeah, although some of those, both of them, I guess, predate my arrival at Origin, right?
Right.
There was more than one attempt to create a Multima earlier than that. And I know at least one of the attempts was in partnership with Sierra Online that was running its own online gaming network. Was that TEN? I don't remember which one it was now. But there was apparently a deal, an abortive deal to do that, and it ended up not panning out. And Cat, I actually just saw him last weekend, actually. He and I hang out every time we can. He play tested a bunch of my board games, actually.
Oh, cool.
While at the Austin Game Conference.
Oh, awesome.
So yeah, we've continued to stay in touch and see each other multiple times a year usually. But he actually was invested enough into the idea of online gaming that, of course, he went off and created Dragonspires in 1995, which did not really succeed that much, but more importantly, gave birth to Furcadia.
Right, which is,
so,
is
yeah, still running, right? So Furcadia is, I believe, a kind of tech extension on top of the original Dragonspires code base. So he actually had that working before UO, got it out the door before UO. And he actually talked with Origin about Dragonspires being Multima and that didn't pan out. And I don't really know the details of it other than Origin deciding to build their own in-house. Why exactly, I'm not sure.
Hmm. Now, Dragonspire, was that that was first person-ish, wasn't it?
No, Dragonspire actually looked a lot like Furcadia. Published a screenshot of it on in that article that I just did on UO's influence a couple of days ago. So you can, but so isometric, like early Furcadia, an isometric display in the upper right, a big chat box at the bottom, a big, you know, for some reason, it seems like all of us back then had these ideas about, well, let's make the game world 320 by 240 and put all this extra crap around the game window. I don't know why we all had that image in our heads. Even EverQuest launched that way originally.
Well, I mean, you know, for those of us who grew up playing Ultima, it doesn't really feel that strange because up until Ultima 6, that was the thing, right? You know,
that's true. But it was kind of a funny thing. I mean, UO to this day wrestles with the legacy of having basically been designed as a limited size window game, right? Rather than one with a larger window. Big window was the big deal in the Second Age expansion. It was one of the key features.
Well, and I mean, it was only, I think, this year that they added like additional resolution scaling options.
Yeah, well, you know, when you've gone and designed your pixel art for a particular resolution, of course, you do end up stuck. It's difficult to scale that in a way that will look good.
This is true. Yeah. I mean, unless you like big blocky textures.
You know, judging by pixel art popularity in the indie world, you'd think the answer would be yes. But I think the pixels would actually need to be even larger. I'm also continually astonished by what modern pixel artists pull off. Of course, they have access to a larger palette of colors.
Mm-hmm. And, you know,
they cheat all the time and have pixels oriented on the diagonal.
Yeah. It's like, why are you doing subpixel rendering in your pixel?
Exactly. But that's all good. I mean, it's actually one of the things that I think people probably don't even remember. UO's art didn't even use all the bits. And it was because we needed to save one bit for transparency. And I guess that cost us some color depth.
Would that have been, would you have been using, you'd have been on 16-bit color by then, right?
Yeah, I believe so, but I want to say it was the images actually only use 15 bits.
Yeah, well, that would make sense if you were reserving one bit for the alpha.
Yeah.
It looked fine to me.
Well, again, you know, when you grow up playing Ultima and it's like, hey, 256 colors is the height of, you know, glory when it comes to making the world look good. 15-bit color is pretty good. 15-bit color is all right, you know?
Yeah, you know, actually, when early on, there's you said, oh, you've heard all the stories. There's so many more stories that haven't been told. early on, and particularly in the alpha, since we only had two artists at the time, Michael Priest, who hopefully is still remembered in the Ultima community. I don't know. He's still around, famous Austin area poster artist. And he was an artist on the Ultima series. There was the city of Austin even declared a Michael Priest Day once. Like, we're talking the guy who started out as a bouncer at Armadillo World headquarters.
Oh, wow.
Did poster art for Zappa, The Stones, I mean, you name it, right? Anybody who came through there, he did posters. And his posters are still hanging on the walls there at Armadillo World headquarters in Austin. He was our original artist. Dennis Lube, who I know you guys were just chatting about, Dennis did, I think, 8 textures. Four dirt and 4 grass. And those were the dirt and grass that we started with and actually continued with, that rich brown dirt and that detailed lawn-like grass that I think is still in the game. Those 4 tiles, 8 tiles total, were Dennis. And then everything else for a while was Michael. And we picked up Clay Hoffman, who was a very recent graduate, as were all of us, right? Michael was the only older guy in the group, right? Everybody else was in their 20s, many fresh out of college. I was fresh out of grad school. Some were fresh out of high school. Wow. Several team members were fresh out of high school. So it was a very, very young team. And Michael was, you know, the oldster around, right? He was the veteran. He did a lot of the early art, but there was no way he could produce art fast enough for us on the design team. And we were actively trying to solve issues, design issues around a whole bunch of things, including multiple story buildings, 3D terrain, and a bunch of other things. So since he was busy making fundamentals, such as like the original corpses, actually, he hand drew. They didn't get rendered. He hand drew them, and he's red green colorblind. And so for a while, when you died, you were green. I don't think that ever made it out to the public, but that's the way it was in pre-alpha development. But would go online and find reference imagery and just start modifying it in order to make walls. And so the alpha version, the pre-alpha version of Britain, which was all we had in the alpha, had very, very different textures. And that's because my wife and I made a whole bunch of them as we were trying to figure out arches and other pieces of architecture, buttresses and so on. And Richard came upstairs and read Michael the Riot Act about how the art wasn't good enough. And he said, "It's programmer art." And Michael said, "But it's not. It's better. It's not artist art, but it's designer art." Most of those got replaced and over the long run. But not all of the artwork got replaced. There's still an enormous amount of plants and flowers that I did that are in the game. So the spiky palm trees and a bunch of the little flowers. There's a particular tree, which is actually a Hawaiian Ojai tree, that is very identifiable and you can spot it because I needed reference material, and what we had laying around the office happened to be a National Geographic issue that had a feature on Hawaii. Oh, so, wow. But that's why you can see there, the snake plant, you've probably seen that one. Mm. That was one that I drew. There's a whole bunch of those in there. And later on I was using Fractal Painter. And Fractal Painter, all of my art background is traditional media. So I didn't use Photoshop, and Fractal Painter didn't do layers. So these were all done on top of a black background, and then they had to be clipped out and put into the game. And that's why so many of them had black edging and black noise. And you can still, if you use the original client rather than the enhanced, you can still see some of the black noise. Later on, an artist named Chuck Christ, who was on the art team, was obliged to go back through all of my artwork and remove black pixels from the edges of it. Mm. Poor guy.
Oh, yeah. That's...
Yeah. Yeah, that's that was in the...
A lot of work.
Was a lot of work. Yeah, that was in the what I think of now as the Skunk Works days, the days when we were still a really, really tiny team and we worked in the only partially demolished, partially built out floor of the building that you could fall to your death from.
Oh, wow.
That story's been told. I can tell it again, but it's been told.
No. That's all right. But yeah, it's just that one was one I'd forgotten about, and then it's just like, oh right, there was hazards.
Oh, it was frickin' freezing too. It was over the winter.
Oh,
it doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't get that cold in Austin over the winter, but it's one of those 2 years it actually froze. Kids were actually. On the highways there, the Origin offices were in a fairly hilly area right by the river.
Right.
And, kids were sledding down the hills on the roads, like sledding down the highway on garbage can lids. I remember driving to work one of those days and watching all these big Texas pickups doing 360 donuts on the roads because nobody knew how to drive in an eighth of an inch of ice. But the top floor of the building was being renovated because the tenant had moved out and they did a complete demo all the way to the outer walls. So the elevator surfaced onto bare concrete, and the only part of the floor that was there was the only drywalled area was the small corner where we were, which was, I guess, 1, 2, 3, 4 rooms and a hallway. That Jeez. Was enclosed by drywall. The rest of it was gone. You could walk off the floor to your death, right? For a little while. So that was weird.
and drywall weird, only, but no insulation?
Yeah, and worse. I mean, our server happened to be directly under the thermostat. So.
Oh, good.
yeah. We were sitting there typing, wearing fingerless gloves in order to type.
I do.
Well,
I do
the server is definitely more important than any of you guys. You know, at least that way the server was at the right temperature.
Yeah. Who cares if we can't develop the game? At least it's up and running. Just a quick note. We've had a couple more people join. So, hello, Draxnath.
Hello. Hola, Raf. Buenas noches.
Buenas noches. Mucho gusto.
Awesome. And Sir Klaus Dragon's also here.
Hello, folks.
Hey there. Guys, I mean, by all means, guys and girls, by all means, just jump in with questions as you go or jump in with comments as you go, because I'll try and drive this, but I'm sure you've got collectively much more imagination than I have individually. So please, by all means, like, jump in.
If you let me, I'll just not stop talking. I should warn you of that.
No, please, go on. I mean, we've got
we've had Dr. Cat on the podcast.
Oh, you know.
Oh, we know. We know. Yeah, no, by all means, just like go on. Because, like, I mean, it's like just the whole, especially for the era in which it happened, right? Because, you know, I have heard Richard's telling and retelling of, you know, trying to convince EA to even fund this thing, right? And like how they were initially very hesitant, and then they did the whole thing with like the send us $5 to get in on the test, and they had like however many tens of thousands of orders. I have 50,000 in my head, and I think that's the number, but
yeah, 50,000's right.
Yeah. But, you know, like we've heard that part and how an EA was like initially very reluctant, but at the same time, like I can kind of get their reluctance because, you know, the internet back in 97 or, you know, 95, even before then was nowadays, it seems trivial to stream copious amounts of content between disparate points on the globe in relatively little time. Back then it was, you know, almost not, you couldn't contemplate it.
So, I actually just did the math on this.
In your article.
Yeah, my cable modem, basically, it's 70.7 megabit connection, right? So that's 70,700 K per second. Whereas back then, we designed for 14 K per second, right? A 14.4 modem, that point is actually a decimal point, right? Yeah. Right? So, yeah, so it's something like a 2500X difference between a 28.8 modem and my cable connection. It was a big deal when we got them to run an extra T1 to the offices just for UO.
Jeez, yeah.
Right? And these days, a T1 is not,
it's not particularly incredible.
No, it's not particularly notable, right? Yeah, I think the stories that, you know, when Richard tells these stories, he tends to tell them from his lofty executive position, right?
Right.
For those of us who were, game industry newbies, because virtually all of us were game industry newbies coming in, the perspective was really different. We knew that something had been going on internally in the company because when we showed up, there were other people there, right? So my personal story of ending up on UO is that I guess once they got the funding, at some point when they got the funding, they went out and were looking for contract programmers. But my understanding is that they weren't actually looking for programmers for that when they set out. Star was, I guess, AP on, what was the name of that game? Bio something. It might actually have even been BioShock.
No, there was BioForge.
BioForge. That's it. It always sticks in my mind because now we've had all these bio games. But yeah, BioForge. I believe he was AP on BioForge and was going out looking for contract programming assistants to help get that game out the door. And that is how he ended up talking to a local shareware game company called Morafware. And Morafware, any of you who were around doing PC gaming in the early 90s might remember these guys as like the kings of the shareware market. They would put out collections of floppy disks and later CDs with like 100 casual games on them, all as shareware. Right. Endless
CDs copies, like that.
Solitaire and, whatever. Rick Delaschmidt was working there, having just dropped out of the University of Texas. And he was this genius kid programmer who was programming on the Texas Super Collider as a high school intern. And he was also somebody that my wife Kristen and I had met online on Worlds of Carnage Mud. And he was one of our regular party members and later guild members later. And later on, he was the one who decided to, hey, I think I'll try writing a mud, and founded Legend Mud along with Sherry Menton, who... his girlfriend at the time, who he met via the mud because she was a friend of ours from college. The three of us had gone to the same college in Maryland. So we're talking, this tight little group, right? And we all worked on Legend Mud together. When Star interviewed Rick, they got to talking about MUDs and online games, right? Rick had landed at Morafware. Morafware had this crazy interview process. They had an open cattle call for programmers to show up. He showed up, and they said to everybody there, all right, well, we can only hire one person, so everybody go off and implement a version of a classic board game. And whoever makes the best one will be hired. So they had this room full of programmers, and all the programmers went home and set out and started implementing, chess or whatever. And they had 2 weeks to do it. Rick logs on to Legend Mud and says to me, hey, remember when you were out here in Austin last summer and you had that board game you made? I said, yeah. He says, I think I want to turn that in as my application. So I sent him the rules to my board game. he got it done over the weekend and had the job before the 2 week period was even up.
Oh, geez.
So, and the game was terrible, by the way. We quickly discovered that my little game had just terrible degenerate strategies and was not very good at all. But, and Morafware wasn't happy at all about the fact that they suddenly were obliged to pay me, they had to send me a check for like a couple $100. It was my very first game. That was my first real game credit that I made money from, was that board game. So Rick was there at Morafware. Star ends up hiring him to come in and put a multiplayer engine behind Ultima 6.
Right, and Ultima 6 was the tech basis for the first attempt, wasn't it?
That was the tech basis for that first attempt. By the time that ended up being like February to May or so, somewhere in that range of 1995.
And we came,
we came out, my wife and I came out to interview. It was probably over spring break. Right. Because I was in grad school. It was probably over spring break in that in 1995. We did the drive out there and we did the interview. We had sent during the previous summer. We had been talking with Rick about building a whole new MUD. And in that whole new MUD, we were talking about how we wanted to push what we were doing on Legend MUD much, much farther. And that included things like, why don't we have full on, not just NPC schedules, but living AI, where, you know, the NPCs should be building their own zones. They should be harvesting things, creating materials themselves. We should have the materials be like implicit properties behind everything instead of having to hand make crafting recipes, you know, and all of this stuff was weird. Weird and cutting edge for text MUDs even at the time. So, yeah, we had all these crazy ideas about how the game could then maybe procedurally generate quests or the NPCs could be much more autonomous. So when they asked us to send in employment applications, they sent us a bunch of, you know, interview questions and whatnot. At the time, Origin, they didn't even yet culturally entirely like calling their designers designers, right? They used to have been called technical design assistants because they were primarily doing level building and, you know, coding, really, scripting things into the games. You know, the designer of the game was Richard or was Warren. And so everybody else was a design assistant, right? So they sent us these samples and, you know, Origin games were, oh, how to put it, technically ambitious and held together with chewing gum sometimes, right?
Yeah, so, I read Mike McJeffrey's Tales from the Pixel Mines and the frequency with which he says, I can't believe this worked when we shipped it made me feel a lot better about my own work.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I can tell you some. I've got stories about how we had to sit down and play every Origin game that was available when we got there. And every single one, I managed to break every single one fatally on the first screen. Anyway, I'll get to that in a second. But they sent us this sample. It was a code sample and said, can you identify the bug in this code? Right. It was that was one of the tests. And, you know, on the MUDs, we had been Legend MUD used an embedded scripting language and with an event-driven, you know, event-driven messaging system, very much like modern UI programming or whatnot. So we were very comfortable in Unix and, you know, manually compiling things and all this kind of stuff. They sent us this code sample and we wrote back saying, well, we think the bug you mean is this missing brace right here. However, this code is stupid. the example of the code was, if I recall correctly, it was a light switch and a light. And light actually checked
the switch every game frame to see if it would be on or off. Rather than when you flick the switch, it changed the state of the light. We were horrified. We were like, wait a minute, where are we ending up working? This code is terrible. They also asked for quest samples, and we sent in quests from Legend Mud as our writing samples, but we also sent in the notes that we had been taking about how we wouldn't do that kind of handcrafted quest anymore. We would lean towards doing something more organic and dynamic using simulation. Well, we ended up getting the job. Sherry actually also applied, and she didn't get it. I don't even know why. It could have been the four of us, but it wasn't quite the four of us again. But both my wife and I did. And then when we showed up on the first day, we asked, so what's the game like, right? Because we figured we are, you know, we're the fresh meat at the bottom of the barrel. There would be a game design. And and Mike McSheffrey says to us, oh, it'll be great. We're going to have this abstract system of resources with simulations, and the game will create quests on its own, and the NPCs will be autonomous. He gave us our notes back as what UO would be. We were freaked out by that. because it became clear pretty quick that, you know, Origin did not actually have any background in making online games. So, yeah, we got there and found out that our notes from a car brainstorm, right, one of those road trip brainstorm things, was going to be the skeleton of the design of Ultima Online. That was a shock.
Wow. And I mean, to hear you describe that, like, of course, the first thing that comes to mind is the scrapped artificial life engine.
That's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
Like, we walked in and Mike said, it'll be great. The dragons will eat the deer that eat the grass. And when they run out of deer, maybe they'll go and attack the players. That's right. That was our design application essay.
Yeah, and as I recall, the players just completely broke that the first time they were exposed to it.
Complicated story there. In the alpha, quite a lot of that worked, right? It was functional, albeit crazy. Like, the alpha was kind of nuts, right? Like, in the alpha, monsters leveled up, right? They actually gained skills just like players did. So that meant that, you know, if a rabbit managed to escape a wolf that was eating it, it would, you know, can I do a Watership Down reference? It would gradually turn into General Woundwort, right? Oof. From managing to escape these wolves, and eventually it might get strong enough to kill the wolves. So in the alpha, we actually lost a fair amount of players to a Vorpal rabbit that had developed out in the forest. The naming scheme for the creatures actually had a dynamic element in it that when the creatures leveled up, they would the name would change. So when you hovered over them, you'd see, like, it started out like a young wolf, and then it became a deadly wolf, a dire wolf, an elder wolf, that kind of thing. So you could actually see, and you'd run into, like, a dire rabbit because of that. So as an Easter egg, we actually hid a Vorpal rabbit in the actual release later.
Nice.
There was actually one rabbit that was insanely powerful.
I have to wonder, just briefly on that, because, like, I remember messing around with, like, Neverwinter Nights modding. And one of the worst things you could do with Neverwinter Nights modding was create a boatload of NPCs that all had to check the same, like, quest variable and then update that quest variable. You would grind the game to a halt for a good 10 minutes while everybody got the update. I have to wonder, like, with stuff like that, where, you know, you have these like, say, your dire rabbit that's out there in the woods somewhere and leveling up on its own. Like, it's a persistent object in the game, right?
That absolutely must
have been crazily resource intensive.
Well, yes and no, right? So it was a different era. Let's start with that. But obviously, things were resource intensive, period, right?
Right, so right.
Take that as a given. I've actually written a lot about... Yeah, I've written a lot about how this system worked. In short, each critter had actually tried to fulfill Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Okay, so each critter sought out... first, it needed food. And it specified a type of food, how much of it needed, the size of its stomach, and how big a bite it needed at one time. Okay. And we were given, this first draft of the actual code for this was written by Scott Phillips, AKA Grimley, if any of you remember him. And, yeah. So the way this worked was every object, every dynamic object in the game had on it a list of resources, and technically those are called productions. So every object was tagged as produces meat up to 3 units, regen rate of 1, you know, so it represents 3 units, regens 1 at this, you know, at whatever rate. So that meant you only had 3 bites for a production value, right? A max of, 1 bite for storing which resource, 1 bite for how much it was, right? Like a bunny represented 5 units of meat and a dragon represented 10,000, right? and one for how quickly it came back in the event of it going down if it wasn't at max, right? This is how something like wool grew back on the sheep. Sheep had produces meat, 15 units, doesn't grow back, because if you're taking meat from a wheel, from a sheep, the sheep is dead. But produces wool, 10 units, regrow rate 1, right? So if you could remove wool off of the sheep, more wool would grow back gradually over time. So each of these production things was only 3 bytes of space, right? Really, really compact. And then everything that was a dynamic object could have an arbitrary list of these. We're talking meat, grass, wood, metal, magic, fish, you name it, right? All these abstract property. And then AIs got an extra, I guess it was an extra 9 bytes, maybe it was an extra 12 bytes, and then where they were allowed to list things they ate, how much they wanted. So a wolf would say, I eat meat. It needs to be at least 3 units in size or it's not worth it to me. My stomach is full when I hit 10 units. And I think that was it, right? Then if they found food, then they fell to the next one, which was, I like hanging around shelters. I like being near forest or near cave or near water. And I need this amount of it, and I consume it at this rate. It acted exactly like food. And then if their needs were met on that, they could actually remember where they found it. Okay, it could actually mark, okay, this is now my home. And it would remember that. And then the next tier down was desires. I really love having gold. And they could check for things that they desired, even inside containers. So like orcs that desired gold could smell it in your bags, right? And they would go after it. And if it was in a container and the container wouldn't stand still, they would kill the container to try to get to it. And then they would pick the stuff up. If they could, they would pick it up. If they couldn't, they just hang around near it, right? Until they got hungry, which had a higher priority. If they could pick it up, they would pick it up, carry it to their home, and leave it there, right?
Oh, wow.
So that was the original design. It was actually the thing that was expensive was doing the radial searches to query what is near me, because it needed to, for this to be interesting, it needed to be querying many screens away, right? And then pathfinding over. The single largest expense on the server at that point was actually the cost of running pathfinding, because just running the A-star pathfinding algorithm was crazy expensive, and doing the radial searches. Sims, the game The Sims, actually ended up using something extremely similar, and they solved that problem by having objects broadcast instead of objects search, which made it cheaper. And I wish we'd hit on that at the time. But here's the untold story. We absolutely had all kinds of weird balance problems with this, but it was working in the alpha. You know, like the classic biggest bug in it was the closed economy. There was a fixed amount of wool, a fixed amount of this stuff in kind of a global bank. And when players had taken all of the wool and fixed it in the form of bolts of cloth, no more sheep could be born.
Ah.
Okay. So that was absolutely an issue, but that was easily fixed, right? Because one of the first things that happened when the world wedged that way, we took away the closed loop. And there's a fantastic economic analysis that was done by Zach Booth Simpson. And you can find it as a GDC talk from 1999 called The In-Game Economics of Ultima Online, where he analyzes that problem in particular and the hoarding problem. But when the whole Ultima 9 team was added onto the game, the programmers from that, by and large, very few people on the U9 team wanted to work on UO. Right. It was not their game had just been put on pause, potentially permanent pause. Right.
Yeah.
And they had been working on it for years at that point. So they were really not happy. And they're told, now you have to go work on the former Skunk Works project that, you know, the one with the super arrogant 25-year-olds who think they know the answers to everything. You have to work for them now. Go do that. It was a very awkward situation. Very, very awkward. And the two groups, a lot of people did not get along at all. We're mostly all friends now, but it was a very, very rough period. One of the programmers was put in charge of doing a rewrite of the resource system because all the alpha code was scrapped.
Ah.
And his rewrite... I remember vividly watching a demo where he had a bear and a hive with honey on the same screen. And the bear took about 15 minutes to find the honey. Right. And so it ended up being completely non-scalable and a massive performance drain and never got fixed. So, you know, today, when I think of something comparable, probably the easiest thing to point at is something like Dwarf Fortress. And, you know, the thing about simulations like that, even back then, you could do a pretty rich, complex simulation, right? SimCity actually is also done using, you know, SimCity is using cellular automata, which, you know, game of life type stuff. UO was explicitly based on early artificial life agent-based simulation. Back then, the folks at MIT were doing sticking light sensors and servo motors on roller skates and making artificial cockroaches that would run away when the light got turned on in the office. That was Rodney Brooks and Marvin Minsky and those guys. That was the stuff that I was reading designing the UO system. It was based on artificial life agents, which is why it ended up being called the A-Life system and resources behind the scenes. So, that stuff can and does totally work, right? ideas like that are still present in games like Dwarf Fortress, No Man's Sky, and of course Minecraft is a resource system. Minecraft is very much like how UO works.
Yeah. My
That was a really long answer.
No, that's awesome. That's
And now we're out of time. No.
Oh my gosh, yeah. You're right about like, gosh, I'm even thinking about, you know, I avoided Minecraft for so long just because it's like, oh my gosh, this seems like an awesome thing and I just can't have that kind of a time suck in my hands. But my eldest plays it now constantly, so I'm constantly like dropping in on her sessions and watching what she creates. But multiplayer.
Minecraft is probably the closest modern equivalent of a MUD. Right?
Yeah, I guess I could see that.
The idea that an ordinary player can start out and they start messing around and they quickly discover that they can play with other people on somebody's server. And most of the servers are pretty stock. And then they go out there and they discover people can run their own servers. And so they start up their own. And then they realize, wait, I can download mods and customize this and make my own worlds and host people. That's exactly what the MUD scene was like.
Yep. And that is
sounds
exactly
an awful lot like Ultima Online, except legal.
Well, yeah.
Well, actually, I do believe that until Minecraft came along, I think it's quite possible that UO Gray Shards were the most commonly deployed virtual world platform on Earth until Minecraft.
I would totally believe that.
Yeah, it's a bold claim, but I believe it too, because, I mean, gosh, I have honestly lost count of the number of free shards I've tripped over. I've tried very few of them, but
The first time I went to China, which was for China Joy or one of those other China game shows, was sometime in the early 2000s, right? Like 04, 05, somewhere in there. And when I get there, I'm astonished to discover that all of these random people know who I am. And I was like, why, right? UO launched in, it was available in Hong Kong and it was available in Japan, but not in mainland China. And they tell me, oh, it's because of Gray Shards. That UO Gray Shards had been in China with hundreds of thousands of players as early as 1998-99. We had no idea. But they said, oh, there were probably easily 500,000 people playing UO in China in 99-2000.
Oh, wow.
That blew my mind, right? Yeah, the reason I say that, you know, when I mean it was the most widely deployed virtual world platform, what I mean by that is that MUDs enabled end user to build virtual worlds, rather than it being, you know, one that you go and connect to, like one service. And right. Then UO Gray Shards come along. There were other, you know, platforms. People tried making graphical MUDs and whatnot where end users could build their own spaces. But Gray Shards became the way in which a whole generation of people learned how to run their own virtual worlds, right?
Yep.
That's the whole deal with a Gray Shard. And, you know, obviously, there's still a bunch of them around, but in their heyday, I remember you could grab one of those apps that served as like a gateway or directory, and you could easily find 100 shards listed. You know, and you could see what the populations were, and there'd be as many people on Gray Shards as there were on the official server. And then, you know, over time, I think that scene has probably shrunk, but Minecraft is another one where you can host your own servers and run your own. That's what I mean by, I think it was probably the most widely deployed platform. I have no doubt that now it's Minecraft, right? There are probably tens of thousands of individually run Minecraft servers hosting millions of people, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, we have a small, we just use the Minecraft Realms, you know, just me and my daughter and like a select few of her friends and cousins. But so that's like the official paid solution as opposed to rolling our own server. Although now with Better Together, that changes things, right? Because like previously with the, because we're all on Pocket Edition, right? She plays on Windows 10, I play on my phone. And Pocket Edition really, Realms was the best way to go because otherwise you're looking at like jailbreaks and whatever else like that. And it's like, I don't want to mess with that.
Well, so you're all Ultima Dragons. You should know this. You guys know about the different colors of moon gates, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Sure. So what was the moon gate color that let you travel between worlds?
Red ones.
Yeah. Red ones. That's right. Red. When users started reverse engineering UO servers, it was kind of a natural evolution from users reverse engineering other aspects of the game. At first, they did it with UO Assist was probably the first biggie, right? Which effectively reverse engineered pieces of the client and the network stream in order to hook in and add macroing and other features. Someone reverse engineered the hue system, which is the system for tinting objects, and they made a tool for creating hues that promptly replaced the official origin one in that we used internally because it was so much better than our official one. So we actually use some of the player built tools in preference to the dev team tools.
Wow.
When we saw that this was, you know, adding value, I guess this was in 1998. This is when Gordon Walt was running UO Live at that point. He'd come over from Kesma. I had a lot of experience running online games there as well. And we got together and said, well, what do we end up doing about these? They're value adds for players. And that's why there ended up being an approval process. You could get your third-party tools approved by Origin to be official. You know, or at least not a bannable offense kind of thing, as long as they stayed within certain bounds. Program didn't last because it meant you had to send in the source code and we had to sanity check it and, you know, for that it wasn't a cheat tool and all that. But when the question came up of, well, crap, now they're going to make whole servers. I suggested, well, we've already taken the server and made it run as a standalone Windows app. We did that because we had a single player tutorial at one point. It was a demo. I don't know if any of you remember this, but I think it only went out on a CD, like with a magazine or something. You could actually get a standalone copy of UO.
It's a pity Joe's not here. He'd probably have a copy of that.
Yeah, it had the server embedded in the client. Okay. And it gave you just like a newbie area so you could do the basic. I said, we've already done that. Why don't we ship that, document the scripting language? The server God mode already had all of the world building tools in it. Right?
Okay.
I said, why don't we sell that and let people host their own shards? And the scripts would be compatible with the real game, right? So we could actually release stuff. They could maybe even contribute stuff back into the game. And I said, if you do this, we could maybe even charge people for hosting their shards if they don't have enough and one becomes popular. And we could even say if somebody made a shard in their house or whatever, they could drop a red moon gate that would be a one-way character copy from the official servers to theirs. Oh. So you would be able to walk into somebody's house and have them advertising their gray shard that wouldn't be gray anymore. And you could go through a red moon gate and visit their game. And all of your stuff would go with, but they wouldn't be able to cheat and bring stuff back into the main game.
Wow.
It boggles my mind how different the world could have been.
Yeah, I really wish we had done that. And I didn't get to do something like that until 2006 when I did MetaPlace. which was basically kind of an implementation of that idea.
Jeez. Which I ran around in the beta for that as well.
Oh, awesome. It's my my forgotten work. Nobody remembers MetaPlace.
Awesome. I was in the beta too.
Oh, good. It warms my heart. So, I really wish we had done that, because that would have, I think that would have actually probably blown people's minds at the time. But it was actually fairly hard to do. We started running into, almost immediately, you run into questions of, well, if it's a one-way copy over to that server, how do we make sure that compatibility hasn't diverged? Do we need to patch their server executables? Right? How does that work? Mm. But all of those things were solvable. But we just had too much stuff going on. And by the time we were doing Second Age, this is, I think, another thing people don't know or appreciate. UO launched. I mean, think of this timeline, right? Rick was making the game, the prototype, the U6 prototype, February to May 1995. Kristen and I showed up September 1st, 1995. Scott had shown up, I think, the week previous. Edmund Meinfelder had shown up the week previous. Andrew Morris had just gotten assigned. He was the one Ultima veteran we had, and he was the original lead designer. He did not make it all the way to ship. In fact, I'm not sure when we lost him. It may have been during the beta. And we had a few guys, Ken Demarest, Jim Greer, Zach, I think, was sort of involved. They all left the first week that we got there. Half the team disappeared, right? Wow. Because they left to go do their own online game startup called NetStorm. Or maybe NetStorm was the game. The company was Titanic. We all thought that was a very bad omen. And they made a really cool online game called NetStorm that I encourage people to go read up on. Jim is best known for founding Kongregate a few years later.
Oh, okay.
Okay. But so they all left. I remember sitting down. Jim is showing me how to launch our prototype UO server. I sit down at the computer and I start typing in the path. And of course, I type slashes the Unix way. And that's why one of the first quotes in the quote file is, that's backslash Unix boy. but so they all disappeared. And then we had, you know, Rick, college dropout, Scott, fresh out of high school, right? And Edmund was the oldest of the programming team. He was actually an actual software engineer. Ooh. And all of us were mud people. All of us were mud people. That September 1st, 1995. We showed the game at E3 in 1996, which is the spring.
Jeez.
Right?
That's 6 months. That's like
we were showing the alpha. And the alpha was actually, people could actually log in, right? That was the winter that we spent on the floor that was half built, right?
Right.
And by 1996, you know, we do this at E3, we get the 50,000 beta people, and EA freaks out and says, what the hell is this, right? You know, and Richard tells that story. I don't know if, like, the way in which they marketing freaked out. Marketing shows up upstairs at that small drywall enclosed part of the building and says, so... Downstairs, we have the editors for PC Gamer. Yeah. They're here to look at Jane's longbow, AH-64. You know, the one Andy Hollis's group is making.
Yeah, that's right, because a lot of the Jane's games were developed at Origin, too.
That's right, they were. Andy's group was one of the big three groups there. There were two other smaller groups. One was the one that did BioForge. And that was Eric Hyman, and the other was Warren's. And both Warren's and Eric's got dissolved during this exact time period. That's how Warren ended up leaving Origin. Actually, Richard came up to us and said, so you may have heard, we cut an entire one-fifth of the company. We cut a production group, you may have heard. And we all stared blankly at him and said, who? Because we lived on a different floor and didn't know anybody.
Ah.
Right? So marketing shows up and says, well, we have a problem. Longbow's supposed to be on the cover, and all they want to ask us about is this Ultima Online FAQ document that's on some web page. And we said, yeah, it's this one. And we show them this web page that has like 100 question FAQ about how the game was going to be awesome and how it worked, and was festooned with llamas and happy buttholes. Happy buttholes were little suns, you know, like a little circle with rays coming out of it. You could think of it as an early Goatsy if you want. That was a prank war that was going on between Richard and his girlfriend at the time.
Oh my.
Where they would leave post-it notes with these little suns for each other. It's a long story. I can tell that maybe over drinks, because it's a ridiculous story. It culminated with a full-page ad in the Austin Chronicle that baffled the city. Why is there a full-size sun on the inside cover of the Austin Chronicle? Anyway, so that was part of a prank war. We participated in the prank war and stuck that icon all over the FAQ. We didn't tell marketing. We'd registered our own domain.
Ooh.
Oh. Origin Worlds Online, owo.com, if you remember that URL.
Yes, I do.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we had gone out and marketed this in order to be able to ship that, you know, the $5 CD, and marketing didn't know that we were running our own website on our own domain, right? And then the press start knocking on their door going, well, but we think we might rather give the cover to that game. They were pissed, right? That's when, you know, marketing starts figuring out that it's turning into a big deal. EA starts figuring out it's turning into a big deal. And it was in this period that we started getting told, you know, Meridian 59's coming and they're going to do 250 per server. We already had 250 per server in the alpha. So it's like, can we make the world bigger? And we'd built a fairly large map, 4 kilometers on a side. That's still a decent size for a game today, actually.
Totally.
But Rick went off and invented multi-server technology in order to take it to 2500. And that meant we threw away the server and we threw away the alpha client and started over.
Jeez.
And showed the game at E3 1997. In beta. So 1 year later, we had 10x the population of the game with a complete code base rewrite. We showed it in 1997. At that point, we had GMs pretending to be monsters. So we had the customer support staff, the QA staff, was literally sitting online, polymorphed into monsters so that we could, because we didn't have monster AI done. And that way, players who came up and played the sessions at the E3 booth demos would actually be able to fight something. People walked away going, wow, that AI is amazing. And then we shipped it that September.
It's just mind-boggling, like,
yeah.
Especially because, like, I've done a lot of, I've had a lot of discussions with, Bill Randolph and other people about the troubled development of Ultima 9.
Yes.
And, you know, like, I mean, that game similarly had, you know, that game had a very long history at Origin, and it could have had a very long development life cycle, but just because they kept... Well, you know, I mean, they transferred the team to UO and then they didn't get most of those people back. So they had to then rebuild most of the team from scratch. And then they rewrote the game a couple of times and just like all of these things kept happening. And so the final version of the game that we know today had really a quite compressed development timeline, and the results couldn't have been more different.
Yes. Well, this was the source of some of those culture clashes, right? Like I said, it wasn't always amicable. The working styles of teams were very, very different. The backgrounds of the teams were very, very different. If I had to summarize it, I would say that the single player Ultima team was veteran programmers who they were much more engineering focused, right? They were software engineers, and they'd been doing this a long time, and they'd been bitten many, many times by, you know, bad calls and, you know, programming choices and all the rest. They were also used to working in single player, one core loop games, right? Event messaging was not a thing in the single player Ultimas. That's not how those games worked, right? I gave the example of the light switch. Completely different way of thinking about things from what the UO team was. All of us were online game people, right? Client server people from the get-go. We were all comfortable working on server side using, you know, one team was used to working with SourceSafe and Visual Studio, right? And right. The other team was used to working with VI and GCC, right? I mean, we're talking just total culture clash. Mm. So there were a lot of cases where the engineers would get into knockdown, drag-out fights because here's this bunch of kids who are saying, hey, so we're going to show up and do the impossible, and you're doing it wrong. And what do you mean you're going to take 2 months, 3 months to write a conversation system? I'll have that for you tomorrow.
Jeez.
And we did, right? Like, I mean, because it would be held together with, I mean, really held together with a different brand of chewing gum. How's that, right? Because it's not that we were, I mean, I think it was a brilliant team, don't get me wrong, but we were also just young and naive and not and arrogant, right? And we knew our problem domain better than any of them did. The flip side was they knew their problem domain better than any of us did, right? But they did come from an Origin culture that, you know, Origin had always had very, very buggy games. I drowned on the first screen of Crusader by ducking off the rolling off the railing. I burned to death on the first screen of Pagan, Ultima 8, by sticking my toe in the campfire and getting stuck in a collision bug and unable to move, right? The first time I played the game, that is how my game ended, right? So, you know, but you guys know this if you've played lots of the old Ultimas, all kinds of really strange behaviors would happen.
Oh, totally. Go on.
Yeah. Yeah, so massive, massive culture clash. And then ship in 1997, September. By Christmas, the only person left on the UO team was me.
Really?
Yes. Our programming team either quit because of the crunch hours. Like at one point, Rick used to leave his beeper in the drawers at the office rather than take it home. At one point, he threw it down the stairs by accident and shattered it, right? Because people didn't want to be on pager duty for the game. Bulk of the team ended up transferred to UO2 or went back to Ultima 9, and many of the others quit altogether. When time came to make Second Age, we ended up having to hire programmers from the player base. And that is how we got Kirk Black, aka Runesaber, Chris Mayer, aka Faceless. Runesaber, of course, famous for designing and implementing Siege Perilous back in the day. Mm-hmm. I think Jason Spangler actually left with Rick and those guys. And, you know, I did not get moved over to UO2. Instead, lead designer of UO2, they named my friend that Damian Schubert as lead designer of UO2. Also from back in the mud days. Okay. We had known Damian since that World of Carnage mud. He was another one of the guys we played with. He had gone on to work at Meridian 59. I had recommended him to them because they tried to recruit me, and I said, I can't. I'm going to Origin instead. I recommended Damian. Damian ended up at Meridian 59. Rich Vogel was at Meridian 59. He's the one who took over the name Dupre. Rich comes to run Origin, run UO and take it through production to finish, and recruits Damien away. And then Damien ends up with two. So I ended up staying on UO. We had to scrounge up, I think we scrounged up two or three designers. Three, I think. Tim Schubert, two more, Bruce, and I'm blanking. So I think Second Age was built with a team of six or seven. You can check the credits. Not many at all, right? I think it might have been as many as nine or ten once we had the art team in the mix. But I want to say the artists were basically on loan. We shipped that in March or April of 98. It was a 2-month dev cycle.
Wow.
So maybe this does explain the old question I have about UO. In the UO picture, we can see on the over the internet, we can see that the origin map of UO had the full continents of Caesarea planned.
Yes.
And in the release, there was only the main continent of Britannia. And yes. I always wondered why we didn't get the other continents in the game. But well, if what you're saying is right, the game wasn't just out. It was just gone out. It didn't have a programming team anymore. And there was already planning an UO2 in 1998?
Yes. The four continents, I drew that map you saw.
Yeah, there's personally, a photo with of you holding it somewhere.
I still have it. I drew that map. Originally we were going to have the four continents, and you know, one of the things that people always talk about is how UO wasn't all that Ultima, right? That's a really common thing. I hear it from dragons all the time. Those four continents there are the four continents from Ultima lore. The lands of the feudal lords and so on.
Yeah, okay. Just some of them are rotated.
Yeah.
Which is exactly how they were in the because
in the timeline. Yeah.
That's right. When Richard did that, originally, you know, he had very limited memory to work with in the computers at the time. Yeah. So that is how he did it. The four continents were originally mirror images and rotations of the original so that he didn't have to use four times the map story.
Yeah, with then little edits here and there.
Yes, he did talk about that on Twitter a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting because there are two continents who are very similar. Can see the rotation. And the other ones, you have to squeeze the eyes and look at all the parts he moved and removed to make them seem unique.
Yes.
So excellent.
So what ended up happening was that we quickly realized that world building tools in UO were inadequate even for building the first continent. When we built the alpha, this is going to sound insane. Okay. Yet another here's an example of what I mean. Team approached things and just hacked and solved the problem. There we are. And we are 24 hours away from opening the alpha test. Okay.
Okay.
And Britain isn't done. The alpha test only had the city of Britain and two chunks of wilderness.
Yes.
One on the left and one on the right. Okay.
There was a map for the alpha who said that. Britain and the land around that.
Yes. And it was wider than it was tall. Right. And we basically built a fence around that area because the whole map was actually there. It was just empty. Right. World building was incredibly tedious. You placed each tile by hand. You could paint them relatively quickly, and we did eventually get
we got tools, but I don't think they were in the alpha. We eventually got tools where you could stamp down larger blocks of tiles at once, but the transitions in between different tile types were placed by hand. Ah, yes. Oh, I made that map too.
Yeah, sorry.
That,
I just
that's my artwork. Yeah, that's my artwork. That was done in Fractal Painter.
Wow.
So the tiles, even the transitions, were placed by hand. So if you painted a dirt road, you had to then paint all the edging and corners around it by hand, which were separate pieces of tile artwork, right? You had to place each tree by hand, each plant, each whatever. So there we are in the run-up to Alpha, and all hands are on deck, madly scrambling to put chairs and tables and lamps and whatever the heck down in all of the buildings in Britain. And we need to fill the map with trees and plants. And the forest is easily two-thirds of the map. So there we are, and it is literally... The Alpha is opening the next morning at 9 a.m. There it is, and it's something like, you know, 4 or 5 p.m. And I go to Star and I go to Rick and I say, there's no way. Absolutely no way. We can't make it. And Star says, you have to. Right? So I said, Rick and I basically went off and solved the problem. We said, well, then what we need is some way. What if there's a way to procedurally put this stuff down? And Rick said, okay, so you need something that's a procedural tool to do this stuff. What if I write something that's a procedural tool? I said, well, but I need to be able to do it, specify the areas, and, you know, even the forest needs to have grass paths and dirt patches and, you know, and the fairy mushrooms can only grow in the clearings. And, you know, we have the forest leaf texture and the dense trees should only be on that. And he said, okay, sounds like I can't just write something. So he went off and wrote a scripting language called eScript that had the most horrendous syntax ever. Every command had to be enclosed in at signs. Every variable had to be enclosed in pound signs, you know, hashtag signs, as the kids call them these days.
Yep.
It had virtually no flow control, right? Because it was literally read word by word off of disk and parsed, right? I mean, this thing did not have a lexer, right? It was read off disk and parsed on the fly. And I sat down. He delivered it within 3 or 4 hours. I sat down and I implemented scripts in that language to procedurally put down large trees only on forest tiles, patches of dirt, and then the right kinds of flora on the grass versus the dirt. I could specify the coordinate ranges, and by around 4 o'clock in the morning, I had procedurally created all of the wilderness and the alpha map.
Wow.
And we launched the next day.
That's intense.
Okay. Though that language, the eScript language, never got taken out of the code base.
Oh, really?
So by the time the main UO being built, by then we went back and said, okay, I need the following brush tools. I need to be able to expand how many tiles I can stamp, make the brush any shape that I want. But then eScript was so useful that I dug up the old eScript tools and I went to Rick and I said, in the regular scripting language, put in an API call that lets me call an eScript. And then in the UO scripting language, I wrote a world building tool for procedural texturing. And by the time we were in Second Age is just about entirely built using that tool. And that tool is still in use today.
Jeez.
And it is entirely written in a combination of eScript and Wombat, which is a UO scripting language. Where UO scripting language Wombat allowed you
This was another thing that was insane at the time. I thought it was horrible that we had to get a client patch in order to add a UI into the game. So I put together a spec and again went to Rick and I said, hey, so if I can send you a blob of markup, and it might have been he had the idea, why don't you send me a blob of markup? Either way, I don't remember whose idea it was. I had to give him the list of what the markup was. So I went and I researched HTML and I basically requested a spec of a type of markup so that you could send arbitrary blocks of text down to the client and the client would dynamically construct user interfaces. Which is how the housing menu, the guild system menu, actually every menu in the game that wasn't a paper container, pretty much, was built that way. Many of them were procedurally generated. Like I had to generate pages of guild interfaces, right? So I wrote code to procedurally generate the markup that would be sent to the client. So yeah, it supported tabbing and all this stuff. So we basically created our own, you know, user interface language for building dynamic UIs. That's what I later used to front end eScript. And last I heard from some of the current UO devs, they're still using that world building tool today.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing.
Epic.
Yeah, we were crazy. I guess that's the takeaway for you. We were nuts and we were doing things that nobody had the good sense to tell us were not really plausible.
You were doing the impossible because nobody realized it was impossible. So you just went and did it anyway.
We just went and did it anyway. Yeah. So part of the answer, that's your answers to, I mean, that was the long answer for a whole bunch of things. Where did the other lands go? That's why we didn't get the other lands. If you look at the map that you just shared and you look at, well, here you've got, you know, the island that is located in between the one that almost looks like a smaller version of one of the continents that is located in between the top two, in between Britannia and whichever one it is on there. You'll notice that it has a pointy top, right?
Yeah.
And if you look at a modern UO, you'll notice that the top end of that island is missing. It does not exist. You'll also notice a giant archipelago of islands south of Britannia there.
Yes.
Most of which did not make it to launch. We sank those islands under the ocean. Same thing with the northern tip of that larger island, which was a spider-worshipping culture based with the name Taratha. And I ended up reusing the culture and the name when we made Second Age.
I remember that.
If you have a copy of Computer Games and Strategy Plus with UO on the cover showing a volcano, that was the centerpiece of the city that I had to sink under the waves because we ran out of time and it had to be cut from the game.
So it still exists in the game, but underwater?
No. We had to delete it, and then I used eScript to turn it into seabed and sank it under the ocean. There is no trace of it left except for the dark gray stone walls with really large bricks and some of the spider iconography and spider webs and whatnot that ended up elsewhere were from the art asset list for Taratha. And a lot of that stuff ended up used in dungeons instead.
This is why the bean counters over at the production companies like EA are hated so much.
There was no way. When the time came that in September, at this point, you know, Richard describes how the series of EA execs, absolutely true. There was a moment Star and Richard were out of town and one of those execs from EA came and interviewed each member on the dev team and they basically had one question. They said, swear to God, we're not here to be political. We're not here to get anybody in trouble. Honest, honest. Tell us, if you could have absolutely anything in the world in order to ship this game faster and make Christmas, what would it be? And if the answer is a clone of yourself, that is an acceptable answer. Like, that's a quote, right? And Star had warned us, they're going to ask, and EA and Origin don't get along. Don't give them any handle. Don't give them, right? Because it's dangerous, right? I mean, potentially dangerous. Could end up with a, you know, leadership change of horses or who knows what, right? We were extraordinarily wary of interference or of, honestly, having some of the U9 people on the, it was turning into a net drag at that point. Some of them, because they didn't want to be there. So, you know, literally, we were told, just say more time. Just say more time. So we all just said more time. The we really didn't want to portray any of the interior dissent within the team up the chain, because if they decide to come in and do things, that could have been dramatically worse. And then later on, yet a different EA exec is there when we're in the beta and the discussion is, are we ready to ship? And they went around to each of the offices of each of the people who was in the leads group. And I remember this conversation vividly, sat down and they said, so just so you know, we're going to, you know, we've been having our go, no go meetings for a while. And the answer keeps being no go. But, you know, we're coming up on September and the drop dead date for making Christmas is soon, right? Manufacturing turnaround times and all the rest. So the phrase was, it would be a career limiting move to vote no go tomorrow.
I've heard that before.
And he apparently had the same conversation with each of the leads. And the next morning, we had that meeting, and everybody except the head of QA voted to go ahead and launch. Me included.
As Kenneth is not here to do his standard outros, he customarily asks people to let the listeners know where they can be found online. So, Raph, if you would like to repeat the URL for your blog and anything else that you would like to, perhaps your Twitter handle or...
Sure. My Twitter handle is Raph Koster, RaphKoster. My blog is also raphkoster.com. And you can also find me Tumblr feeds from my blog as well, if you're a Tumblr person. So, yeah, you can find pretty much everything I've ever written or presented goes up on there. It's like a million words of content. So you could be reading quite a long time.
Indeed. Draxanath, where can we find you?
You can find me on Steam and also on Facebook. I have a page for my project, Chronicles of the Dragon Goddess.
Fantastic. Revelox, where can we find you? Are you still here?
Yes, sir. I can be found. I can be found on Twitter as Revelox. I can be found in UO as Revelox. I could also be found in Shroud of the Avatar as Revelox.
Okay. Sir Klaus, is this your first time here?
I was on for the RPG vocal chat with Nathan Furry.
Well, where can you be found online? Listeners who might want to see more of what you have to say.
I'm online mostly on Twitter, but I don't say much. I'm mostly lurking for accounts on every good information I can get. And it's at P, and after that it's my name. So it's a bit complicated, so I'll leave it in chat. It's better.
Okay, well, hopefully that'll wind up in the show notes. I don't want to commit Kenneth to necessarily getting everything that I have said needs to be in the show notes into the show notes, but hopefully that'll be there. As for me, you can find me primarily tapestryofages.com and Dark Unknown Game on Facebook are the main places for my game, The Dark Unknown, which is, of course, not done. And Twitter as at Tapestry of Ages. So that's... Vanzilar, unfortunately, may or may not still be lurking, but doesn't have a microphone. So once again, Designer Dragon, Raph, thank you for coming out. Everybody, thank you for participating. Thank you to Kenneth for setting this up again. It's good that he has a little bit more time again after adding to the household. And as always, be virtuous.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.